Welcome to Mid-Century Modernism with Monique, your go-to podcast for all things architecture, design, and innovation within mid-century modernism. Join me on a journey through the golden age of design, where every episode brings you fresh inspiration for modern living and unlocks the secrets of this iconic and timeless style. What are we waiting for? Let's get started. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Mid-Century Modernism with Monique. I'm Monique Anton, your host, and it's such an honor today to have Paul Adamson on the show. Hello, Paul.
Hi, Monique. Thank you so much for having me.
It's an honor. Paul Adamson is a San Francisco-based architect. He's a writer, preservation advocate, and educator. He's the author of the book Eichler, Modernism Rebuilds the American Dream, which can be found on Amazon, and is a founding member of the Northern California chapter of Docomomo, was instrumental in the successful nomination of two Eichler neighborhoods to the National Register of Historic Places. He is currently teaching at the Academy of Art University, School of Architecture, serves on the boards of AIASF, the Center for Architecture and Design, and the William Worthen Foundation. I would love to know about these foundations and about your passion with this.
So it just develops from a passion for architecture. I've been practicing now for like 40 years. And since about 10 years ago, no, 20 now, I got involved with AIA because I gave a talk at their chapter headquarters on Eichler Homes. This is in the run-up towards publishing the book, and I was out giving talks to sort of spread the word about, you know, what wonderful things they were, the Eichler Homes, the legacy, how they came to be. And of course, this was an audience which included architects, so among that coterie, there's always been a fascination with the homes and how they came to be and why it was such a kind of relatively short-lived enterprise. But I was giving a talk, and it was a packed house. There was standing room only. And when we wrapped up, someone on the staff kind of pointed to me and did this come here with her finger, you know, because I was somebody, it looked like, who could, you know, help build membership and enthusiasm for what they did. And yes, they invited me to be a reviewer for homes on their home tours that they give every September during Architecture in the City. And that seemed like a lot of fun. You know, you get inside these newly completed architectural gems in some cases.
Right.
And what, you know, who wouldn't jump at that chance? So I did that for a couple of years, and then they said, well, you've been active for a while. Do you want to be on the board? And little by little, you know, I got sort of lured in and have assumed a tiered set of leadership roles, which led to being the board president last year. So it's been an opportunity to just kind of collaborate with architects, you know, advocate for the profession, advocate for design at large in a very conducive atmosphere, you know, a nice, as I say, collaborative atmosphere rather than competing with one another in business. So it's the sort of antidote to professional practice, and it's informative at the same time and fun because it's a great crowd of people to be part of.
I love that. How would you describe your career going through? I know you were drawn to Eichler's and you loved architecture, but you're involved with so many different things. How would you describe this process?
You know, lots of architects will tell you the first time they decided to be an architect, and it's often when they were a kid, you know, playing with Legos or something like that. And it wasn't exactly that way for me, but I grew up in the Bay Area, and from an early age, I became familiar with Eichler homes through my parents, who somehow knew about them and would point them out to me as we drove around on the weekends and they happened to spot them. And it sort of, you know, caught in my mind that these were something special, and I could see that they were different. And then I have a legacy of artists in my family. My grandfather was a painter in England, and my mother was an artist and studied architecture, actually, and worked for a landscape architect when I was young in Larkspur. And so it was sort of in our family. And my father was a construction cost estimator, a QS, they call them in England, which is quantity surveyor. And he started a business here. So I was kind of saturated with architecture, building, you know, as a kid.
The whole family.
It was dinner conversation. And I'm the only kid. So the conversation is, you know, wherever they wanted to take it. And so I learned from that. And when I was applying to college, I applied to architecture school. And I remember there was an architecture aptitude test that this one school I was applying to, none other in the country, offered it. And I scored like almost a perfect score because I just had the vocabulary, right? And then some of the aptitude as well. And so that got the ball rolling for me. So, you know, I did college, I did graduate school, and that combination is just marvelous because I got the how-to in college and I got the wherefore and why in graduate school, which just stoked my curiosity. So I was, you know, when I first came out of school and I was working in New York as an architect, I have never been happier. Wow. I was like, wow, I made this incredible threshold. I created this opportunity for myself. And I was working for an architect who would become world famous. So I couldn't have been in a better place. For me, it was like, you don't know sometimes how lucky you are, right?
Right.
And it naturally, it took a lot of hard work to get there. But I liked the process. So I lucked out. So I'm one of those lucky people who got to do what they really wanted to do.
Love that. Amazing. Well, I've always been a huge fan of your book. And when I first discovered it, I loved it so much that I based my Eichler documentary film on it. And you were so amazing being, you know, the speaker in the film. You were so amazing to interview. So I really looked to that as sort of the, I want to say, Bible of Eichler's, Bible of the Eichler development. What would you say inspired you the most from Joseph Eichler's work and what he did here in the Bay Area and in New York?
So I can go back to early memories of seeing Eichler homes in the subdivisions around where I grew up, which was Sunnyvale, Los Altos. And what struck me then and then inspired me later, as I was saying, when I kind of was nurturing my curiosity in the field, was that Eichler Homes developed really, really high quality design for everybody. They were intended for, you know, anyone within reach of a middle class home, right? And that was so unusual, and it still is today. That's why they're even more valuable than they've ever been. So that's what inspired me, was this combination of really fine design with a really modest means of production so that they became accessible to as many people as possible.
I love that. So about the book and your experience writing the book, you worked with Marty Arbenich and you worked with Ernie Braun. What was that like, working with such a master of photography?
Well, I mean, huge credit to both, obviously, but I'll start with Marty because he's an organizer. He's a journalist by training, so he knew how to find the stories and the people who could tell them and get us to meet them in person and kept me on task. We wrote articles together for the newsletter, as you probably know, and that was a way to kind of keep the product churning. So we amassed enough material to eventually form the book. But, you know, illustrating it for the articles and then for the book, we drew from Ernest Braun's photography, and he was a master. You know, everybody knows Julius Shulman. Not everybody knows Ernie Braun, but he's equally good. And his photographs are so characterful because he often put people in them to show you what life would be like in an Eichler house. And he had this enormous trove of photographs at his house that Marty and I kind of thumbed through over many weeks so that we could cull from thousands down to however many it is in the book, a couple of hundred probably, to tell the story in the best way possible.
I love that. And along with your work with preservation, you've done so much for these homes, and you talk about sustainability. I wondered if you could share a little bit about that sustainability with us.
You know, Eichler homes are actually a pretty good lesson in sustainability in some ways. And I'll tell you how they're not and how you might deal with those. But first of all, I think they have an economy of means. You know, there are not a lot of parts and pieces to these homes. They're not complicated in design. And they're not complicated in execution, actually. And they're lightweight. Buckminster Fuller used to ask, how much does your building weigh? As a way of assessing its relative value. If you're getting a lot for a little of expense, then you've got high value. And I think that's what the Eichlers are about. They're about great space for the money. And so that's, I think, one primary lesson. Don't expend more resources than you need to achieve the ends you're looking for.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, we know now because of rising energy costs and our need to kind of scale back on energy expenses and the means mm-hmm. by which we derive energy, that we need to be more conscious about how that's managed in buildings. And Eichlers are, you know, not energy efficient because they don't have very much insulation. They've got single pane glass and a lot of it, but you can overcome that.
Right.
You know, modern construction methods and technologies enable us to design in this beautiful open manner and still be responsible regarding energy use.
Yes. Well, that brings me to my next question, which is, we wanted to share with listeners your ideas and ways to improve mid-century modern houses. Could you share with us a little bit about that?
Sure.
As well?
I mean, we could start with the obvious. When you look out the back windows of an Eichler house, it's nothing but glass, right?
Right.
Which is essentially an opening in the envelope from an energy perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever heat is outside is going to come in. Whatever heat is inside in the winter is going to go out. So overcoming that that transitory nature of the climate is essential from the get-go. So we have insulated glass. You buy the same size pieces of glass, but there's two put together with a gasket around the perimeter. That airspace is remarkably useful in resisting thermal transition from inside to outside or vice versa. Then you can coat the glass so it reflects back the UV light. So that is another form of mitigating heat transfer. And you can fill it with argon gas. So these are three technologies in one in insulated units that you can use to replace these big lights or panes of glass in your home. And I've done that in my own house, which is very similar to an Eichler. And the difference was profound. Okay,
wow.
So that's insulation. That's insulation in a part of the house you can see. Where you can't see it is in the walls and on the roof.
Mm-hmm.
So using high-density foam on the roof, using bat insulation in the walls, they start to transform the house from just a conduit for energy dispersal into a place to contain it and stay warm in the winter and cool in the summer.
Mm. For those of you listening, Paul has an amazing house, a Roger Lee design, and I hope you can share with us some about this amazing architecture.
Well, you know, it is a beautiful house done in much the same manner, the same style as an Eichler home. Its difference is that it's two stories, so it's like a tall box, but mm-hmm. with that height goes double height glazed openings in the living room, so, twice the opportunity for heat to escape. But, and therefore, I guess I've had, to learn the lessons of what many Eichler home owners have learned through their experiences on my own and mitigate those conditions, which were less than ideal in this house. I mean, what drew me to it in the first place and drew me and my wife, Gabrielle, was this openness. You can live in and around it in a way that just is so unusual. And it's beautiful. And every morning we get up and we go, wow, this is beautiful. I mean, oh, yeah. We look outside across the bay and, you know, our cats are running in and out all day. And it's just like being in nature, and it's marvelous. But over the course of time, we've had to make repairs. And as we did so, we made improvements. So our kind of catchphrase, at least recently, has been build back better, borrowing a phrase from Biden's administration. And what that means is replacing the big, you know, windows with insulated glass, putting foam on the roof, insulation in the walls, getting a more efficient heating system, and where necessary to restore from decay the structure, we use more durable materials. And I'll just give you one example. The deck is a very kind of economically produced part of the building with, I think it was half or three-quarter inch boards, pretty slim, and they'd begun to get weak as they dried out over time. Now, this house mm-hmm. was built in 1960, so over time it's sort of, you know, begun to show its age, as it were. And so we invited some contractors over to explore redoing the deck, and one of them was just stepping around and put his foot right through the deck and almost fell through. And you know, that illustrated the need to replace it. But when we did so, we not only had them install new beams under the deck and extending under the house, we put waterproofing on top of those beams, which wasn't there originally, so we're building it back better. And then we used ironwood, or ipe is the species that we used, but it's very, very dense wood that comes from Australia, and it's incredibly durable. It's very, very hard. And we used that instead of the old Doug fir planks that used to be there in the original construction. Yeah, so it's built to last. You know, the second time around, it's going to be sturdier than it was the first time. And that's kind of our recipe, is if we need to do some restoration, if we want to do some upgrades, we find a material that's a bit more durable than the original. And where it doesn't compromise the character, we install that in lieu. So it's a transformation over time.
Yeah.
And we deviate here and there a little bit from Roger's intent. But we don't consider ourselves historic preservationists when it comes to our house. We're more like interpretive preservationists. So we try and keep the spirit. And I think we are being successful in that way. But changing the materials here and there to make it a little bit more refined and a little bit more resilient.
It's very important. What, over the years, I've known from sending some clients to you, you've worked on commercial properties and residential properties. What has influenced your design the most, do you think?
Well, that's a good question.
Or were there any architects that you looked at and learned so much from?
Yeah, you know, it's a great question, because I think all of us carry with us experiences that go way back to when we're, you know, children and growing up. And so growing up here in the Bay Area, where we could live indoors, outdoors all the time, that was a really kind of fundamental ideal that I developed. And when I was in school in New York City, I would always design like courtyard buildings and indoor-outdoor spaces. And sometimes the professors would look at the drawing and say, this is a very Californian design, you know? But I was just doing what came naturally. But I did have some specific like heroes or mentors when I was in school, and then when I started working immediately after school. There was one architect named Steve Hall, who's now world famous, and he taught me that every good design has a concept, an intellectual idea that founds it and enables you to find unique ways to express the architecture. And another was Raphael Vignoli, who has just recently unexpectedly passed away, but he was an enormous influence. He's the person I worked for when I was in graduate school on holidays, and then after I graduated, they hired me, and I was super fortunate to be able to spend some time there and work on a number of commercial and civic buildings with Raphael and his team. And what was extraordinary about his talent was his ability to bring together really complex programs, which is, you know, the uses of the building in ways that looked simple. In other words, he'd put it together with an elegant gesture, and mm-hmm. the overall look was just beautiful and apparently simple, but not, you knew it really wasn't, because you had to grind a bit to get there. But he was enormously talented. So that idea of, you know, bringing things together in an elegant synthesis was something I experienced secondhand, I guess, you know, working next to Raphael when I was a junior architect. But then there's a hero from history, Le Corbusier, and I experienced some of his work in France when I was studying in school, and it's just indelible. It's extraordinary when I pick up a pen now how one of his works comes to mind as a precedent for solving an issue I'm dealing with today. It happens over and over again. So that was an influence early on that just because I experienced his works firsthand, it's really stuck with me. And so those are three profound influences. So I think it's pretty fair to say whenever I'm working on a design, thinking about it even, not even drawing it, it's the recollections I have from being with those people and experiencing those buildings that I draw from. Mm.
That's very special. What are you working on now? I know you had worked on a home in Los Altos here on the peninsula, and just excited to hear about your projects.
Yeah, when I came back from New York to California, because I thought, here's where I want to sort of build stuff for myself. You know, if I'd stayed in New York, I would have worked for a master and managed his projects, and who knows if I would have become a designer. So I sought to sort of expand my opportunities by coming back here, but also because building in this environment just seemed like the most natural thing to do and something I aspired to do. And I had lots of heroes who'd built out here in the mid-century in particular, and I wanted to kind of follow in their paths. Mm. So my parents were enormously generous and offered the opportunity to me to design a house for them in Los Altos, which would replace the house I grew up in.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So,
wow.
So I came with this sort of head full of learning and experience that I'd had going to graduate school in New York and working there, and sort of tried to put it all together all at once in one house, you know, which was impossible. But I think it came out well, and my family was pleased with it, and it was a start for my career on, you know, doing from start to finish.
Right. Sort of coming full circle.
And at a scale that I could grasp, you know. I mean, working in New York, I'd worked on colleges and high rises, and that was, you know, hard to conceive at whatever I was at the time, 23 to 30. Mm-hmm. years old, how to put one of those together, but a house I could conceive of by myself. And that was the challenge they put before me, which, you know, dream it up, do whatever you want. But we have constraints, you know, these are how mm-hmm. we want to use the house and so forth. And here's the budget. So I had to really, you know, hold myself accountable, and it was a tremendous opportunity, and I, you know, enjoyed that, and it gave me a lot of confidence going forward in doing things for other people, working at other firms, you know. So that was a start, and I've done a number of things since, from high-rise hotels to college buildings and retail and some multifamily housing. Mm-hmm. But most recently, I've actually been looking towards doing more residential work. Part of that's out of necessity. I was an expert in high-rise business hotels. And as of March 2020, guess who wasn't going to high-rise business hotels?
Right. Kind of put a stop to all that.
Yeah,
abruptly.
Nobody. And so investment in that market just disappeared. At the time, I had four really interesting projects going, including two new build projects in San Jose, in downtown San Jose, both additions to historic landmarks. Mm. So it was kind of a great opportunity to start or to work on skills that I'd been developing, historic preservation, mm-hmm. architecture, working in urban contexts. One of them was a high rise. So I was able to put a lot together, and they were both hotels. So mm-hmm. that was cool, but it stopped, you know?
Right.
So I took a breather. I went back to teaching. I got deeply involved with AIA in the past couple years. And so now I've been looking around for other opportunities that have to do with residential architecture, building in this natural environment like you have here in your house in Portola Valley. Mm-hmm. And we're actually helping, my wife and I are helping, she's also an architect, we're helping a friend conceptualize some ways to improve their property in Richmond, just north of El Cerrito where we live. And they've got this wonderful site with it's a long, skinny triangle of a site, a really weird shape, but with a cross slope that faces the bay. So they got a sweeping view from like Mount Tam to San Francisco. And so a place with enormous opportunity, and they had this really modest program. They asked us to see if we could fit an ADU, a sauna, a hot tub, outdoor shower, you know, just beautiful suite of smaller elements on their property. So we're tinkering with that, trying to take advantage of their really beautiful circumstance. And,
so
you know, the idea of building on a slope facing an enormous view where we can exploit their being right. in nature, again, their opportunity to be in nature, provide opportunities for hospitality. They're very, very generous people and generous hosts. And so helping them, you know, express themselves in that way on this special site is just
it's a dream job.
Yeah, it is. It is. It may not be for fee, and they may not even build it. But for me to kind of nurture those thoughts is just really, really enjoyable.
Yeah, yeah. I love that work that you're doing. And I think that your teaching, you can definitely see your passion coming through with that for your students. At AIASF, I know they're doing a lot of, I've been to a lot of talks. We talked about the competition that's going on there. You have a housing, the San Francisco 2050 competition. Can you share or talk about that for a little bit?
Well, as your listeners will know, we've had a housing crisis in California, and in particular in San Francisco and the immediately surrounding neighborhoods for years now. We just haven't been keeping up with demand, right? And part of that is zoning, which has prevented areas from developing higher density. And that's particularly acute in San Francisco. So we thought, as a housing committee, and I've been co-chair of the housing committee at the chapter for several years, we'd love to do a competition to help sponsor designs that can show people that higher density, more urban ways of living in the city that can accommodate more people is good for the health of the city while providing opportunities for people to live close to where they work and to make them more affordable. The more you build, the more affordable they are, the more you can take advantage of land for the betterment of more people. I think the better off you are, and certainly the more vibrant life is in the city. So we've put out a call for entries called Housing Plus San Francisco 2050, because we want to ask people to submit designs for new typologies or new ways of conceiving smaller multifamily dwellings that can go in these areas, which until recently have been downzoned to single family only. So we can develop the potential for new residents, or bring even residents who've been displaced back into the city. And it's a trend that's happening across the nation. Other cities and states are reversing these older zoning laws, which created these enclaves of single family only right near the center of town. And if those can be transformed, it's another way of opening up to enable more housing and more affordable housing. So we're hoping to get some really great ideas from that, and ideas that can be translated into fact. We're working with one of the planners at San Francisco Planning who's intent upon using ideas from this competition to help develop as-of-right design formula for development. So people don't have to go through a long design review process to get something built for new residents, but can get a design built based on the smart ideas we hope to harvest from this competition to get things done in an expeditious way.
Right.
So yeah, we're really looking forward to how that develops.
Oh yeah, it's very motivating for so many people. I read that you had said, not only in your book, but I went to one of your talks, and you said that doing what Joseph Eichler did and the amount of homes and the development is not, no one else can replicate that. No one else can do that. Do you think it is possible for someone to mass produce a great design like that again? And hopefully you do.
If it's been done once, it's possible, right? And so someone needs to step up. I agree. I mean, I think that people have the more power than they realize as consumers to ask for better work. And where is more important to have good work than in a dwelling?
Absolutely.
This is the background for one's life, and having a great circumstance, even if it's modest in scale, to live in when you're growing up can be the foundation of a beautiful life, or a creative life, or one that makes you feel as though you're open to opportunities. It's possible. And I think that what made Eichler Homes special was Joseph Eichler's inspiration in the first place, which was in part living in a Frank Lloyd Wright house and understanding the virtue of design in a compact space in nature the way he did. But also he was masterful in hiring people at every step of the process through development who were really equally passionate and talented and smart. So it's a team effort. Every right. Design and construction process is a team exercise, and every person on that team has to play to their best abilities for you to be successful at the highest level. And that's what Eichler did. So yes, it's possible. It does take that concerted team effort. What's, I think, in our favor and might allow us to be optimistic about that sort of thing happening again is people's awareness of the value of good design. And I think as consumers these days, you know, the cohort younger than me are very much aware, particularly of mid-century stuff, because it's been so popular, so it's been in the media. But having seen it and experienced it, whether it's by furniture or in their own home or a friend's home, there's an understanding of those intrinsic elements of modernism, that kind of inherent modesty, but graciousness of space, elegance of material use, economy, all coming together, that I think it's making for a very aware kind of marketplace.
Yes.
And so if people are looking for it, somebody's going to try and meet that demand.
Absolutely.
So I'm optimistic.
I see it every day. People call in to my real estate firm saying, we want more modern homes. We want more mid-century modern design. Where are they?
Oh, wow.
And we always have very, low inventory. So when I licensed the plans for Eichler's and worked with architects to fit them to code, we had a lot of people skeptical, can this be done? It definitely can be done. And you mentioned that there was a woman in Oregon that reached out to you, and she had wanted to partner with you for this. I think that there might be this next push for, large development of these homes. We'd love to partner with anyone we could, but what was her, she had reached out and said she wanted to do this as well.
She'd been working as a manager in a software industry and was reaching the point where she could retire and retire a little bit early and wanted to exercise a passion that she'd been nurturing for many years and do development of homes. And she, she's obviously a sensitive person. From what she told me, she would be distressed to see the sort of mediocre housing developments going up around her when she realized by example, some of which she saw in the Eichler book, that it could be done so much better. And
yes.
So she read our book and called me and said, boy, this was exciting. you know, how can you, what can you do to help me get started as a developer? You know, and I said, well, look for people who are doing it now, who might be doing it to the level that you aspire to, and see if you can interview them and find out, you know, how they got there. And I'm happy to help with ideas and resources and connections if possible. But it was just exciting that someone felt the passion, you know, and had the means and wanted to dig in and make it happen.
Wow.
And I think she's not alone. I mean, when we were doing research for the housing competition, we came across young developers in the Seattle area who were investigating ways to make high quality, high density development in areas that had been sort of, you know, mediocre tract environments in the past. But now with zoning loosening up to enable different kinds of development, they were being really smart about it. This group that we interviewed were a couple of MIT graduates who'd created a business plan while in school there and then reached out to architects in Seattle and were putting the pieces together, building that team of experts like Eichler did. So they're in the early stages. So I'm hoping that we'll be able to see the products of their labor soon, and that'll be one of those resources this woman who called me from Portland can lean on to, you know, take her next steps, and maybe this will be part of a movement.
I love it. Well, thank you for being a part of leading this movement. Thank you so much for this book. Thank you for all you do for preservation. We will leave the links for DocoMomo for everyone listening, and you can get Paul's book online on Amazon. And if you are thinking about development, if you do have this passion, please reach out. Get involved, get people together, and let's make it happen. Thank you so much, Paul, for being on the show.
Monique, it's been a joy, and I really appreciate you inviting me. So
thanks
so much.
Thank you. Thanks for tuning in to today's episode. I hope you had as much fun learning about the world of mid-century modernism as I did. You can also catch the show on my YouTube channel, where we walk through some of the most stylish mid-century modern homes in California. Just search for Mid-Century Modernism with Monique and hit subscribe. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast and leave me a comment to let me know what you think. Your feedback helps me make the show even better. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time on Mid-Century Modernism with Monique.